Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. Now, in opening yet a further session of this hearing, one that I had originally hoped we would not require, I do have to apologise profusely to those who are giving us more time than they had originally planned, and rest assured that the examining authority is extremely grateful for the time commitments of everybody around the table, and we trust that, you know, the importance, the necessity now of completing a track on which we have started is something that we are all convinced of, and so therefore we do, I believe, need to make the time to complete the circle and to enable the interested parties now to cross-examine Mr. Lynas's witnesses. And then we will do everything within human power to pass through the remaining agenda items with brevity. But clearly my original estimation of a 6:30 finish is not going to happen. It will be more like an 8 p.m. finish, but we will do our best to get there as soon as we can, and if we can achieve it sooner than that, ladies and gentlemen, I believe we should. So if we could all focus on being as brief as is possible with obvious limits around needing to make points and make cases. In that respect, though, I do make clear, as I have previously during this hearing, that we do have deadline five and that matters of detail can be pursued out in writing. That is one of the glories of the national infrastructure process. It is a primarily written process, and if you feel walking away from today that there are elements of completion that you need to make, do use that further opportunity. So can I move then to Port of London and ask for the commencement of a cross-examination of Mr. Lynas's witnesses.
Thank you, sir. Alex Tillerstone from PLA, acting for the PLA and ESL. I was going to have some questions that I think the panel has already picked up on the theme of the queries that I had for Mr. Rogers on scoring Class 1 and Class 2 ships for collisions generally rather than looking at collisions between specific types of vessel. So, so far as possible, I won't spend time duplicating anything that's gone before. But for Mr. Rogers, you said there were extensive discussions around many aspects at the workshop. Did you take away from the workshop that conclusions drawn by Marico in relation to the four hazards that were covered were sufficiently clear to all the parties?
Ed Rogers for the applicant. I took away from the workshop that the discussions we had around those four individual hazards were known and understood and contributed by most of the people in the workshop, with the exception of the parties who were there largely for observation.
Okay. Well, was there anything that you could have done to make it clearer?
Pick up on and clearer for?
Clearer for the parties there. So it seems that your view is that it was clear. That seems to be what you're saying. So do you have any explanation for the disparity between your position that matters were agreed and were clear, and that of other parties in attendance that although matters were discussed, they were neither clear nor agreed?
I'm slightly confused. Within the workshop, we went through the four individual hazards. There was a consensus around the scores that we put in there. There was opportunity and questions asked where there was a need to spend more time or look at it. There was clearly a time frame dimension to the workshop. But I wouldn't have expected coming away from the workshop that there would be too much need to undertake the same process again. I think it's always possible that people will reflect and think about things over time, and that's to a certain extent human nature. So I still don't really understand your point.
I think I'm just trying to get to an understanding of what was agreed and what was not agreed, because I think we've suggested a number of times today that matters were discussed, but it seems from the parties here today that they've come out of the meeting with different ideas of how the risk was calculated. So do you accept that it's very difficult to see how there would be an agreement on your approach if there was no common understanding of what the approach was?
I think, first of all, we need to look at the lead-up to the individual workshop itself. We went through a number of pre-hazard workshop meetings to talk about the process and to look at the SEZ that had been put in place to identify and look at the hazards that we could assess against. 3 days prior to the workshop, I issued a workshop pack that included details around the hazard, the agenda, the methodology, ancillary information around the AIS vessel tracks. There were some communication between myself and Richard Jackson around possible incident investigation reports that could also be put in place. And indeed, I think we did discuss actually at the workshop. And then on the day of the workshop, we went through a prescribed agenda. We talked about the individual specific hazards, in great detail. And the first one, and I think it was remarked at the workshop that in most of these workshops, you spend a lot of time talking about the first hazard as people kind of get calibrated to the process. And as time goes by, people become more used to it and in line with the methodology, and things proceed faster. So I'm still surprised, I guess, by having spent all that time and the lead up to it and to have tried to do that in the most transparent and open way at every stage, to come back a few days later with, I guess, your point that your clients didn't understand the process of the workshop or the risk assessment methodology, which is a methodology that has been used certainly by the PLA for many years.
Yes, I think the methodology itself has been used by the PLA, but I think the question, which I still don't quite understand the answer to, was how can there have been an agreement on the approach when the parties didn't have a common understanding of what the approach was? Is it your position that there was agreement on your approach?
It was, to my mind, a matter of fact that there was an entire agreement with the approach, and at each stage questions were asked around the identification of hazards, the process and methodology, and extensive discussions.
So despite the fact that the parties came away with a different understanding of what the approach was, there was agreement on it?
I don't yet see that there's actually been anything put forward that says that there was a different approach to the parties afterwards.
Okay, thank you. If we just talk about the scoring of the first hazard, because you've said it was discussed at length, I can see that you would not want the IPs to be influenced in their scoring for further hazards by having access to the first score. Do you accept that Marico, however, did have access to the resulting risk scores for the first hazard and whether they fell within that a lot?
The methodology for calculating the resultant risk score is undertaken through the Hausmann algorithm. I did not know what the output risk score was. I have done this, a number of times over the last 15 to 20 years. I probably had a reasonable understanding of what it could be, but in terms of me sat there looking at an individual risk score as people were identifying and putting in numbers, that's just not the case.
Okay. So America are in exactly the same position as the interested parties.
Ms. Dillerstone, would you mind if I briefly just interposed a question that has really been tickling the back of my mind for some time in relation to this very point. In terms of this type of methodology very broadly used for an enormous range of combination quantitative and qualitative processes, not just risk assessment, one of the things that does seem to happen reasonably commonly is that independent workshop facilitators are used. So that in a sense, there is a gap between the interests of a client and the person or persons driving the process and mining the data. And so that if there is an interposing process, some form of black box or algorithmic process that is then used, that the facilitator is not unduly influenced by expertise or indeed even knowledge about precisely how that might outturn, so there is a neutrality around essentially the drawing of scores out from participants without necessarily knowing what the consequences of those scores might be. Did it at any point occur to you that not just in relation to this piece of work, but in relation to pieces of work more generally, that maybe you are in a world, you're operating in a world where to essentially rebut a fairly substantial criticism of your method, that an independent facilitation input might be valuable.
My view is that Marico have been commissioned to undertake a navigation risk assessment, and we've been undertaken to do that as an independent organisation. We're not there to necessarily push the views of either the interested parties or indeed the applicant. As a chartered engineer myself, I take that responsibility very seriously. So, I guess, to put it bluntly, the accusation that we're trying to manipulate things through this process, when at every stage, certainly in the Endemen IRA, where some concerns have been raised about consultation, which I think are unfounded, at every stage we've been as open and transparent as possible.
Well, rest assured, no such accusation emerges from the examining authority, but essentially, you know, there is this question around independent facilitation is just a mechanism of dealing with an apparent conflict of interest in process, and I just wondered if it was one that you had ever reflected on at any point in your professional career dealing with these sorts of processes.
Most of the hazard workshops within this field, within offshore renewable energy navigation risk assessments, don't have independent facilitators. For the workshop on the 29th, we had the MCA in attendance as observers. They weren't necessarily there in a capacity to input into risk scores, is what they said. They were involved in the process by, you know, at times asking questions, sometimes searching questions, both of the applicant and also interested parties. So that's the approach I would take.
Okay, and in your view, it's not only an approach you would take, but an approach that a range of competitors offering similar services in the marketplace would take.
Yes, that's correct.
Okay, apologies, Mr. Stone. I just wanted to
Thank
see
you,
where
sir.
That went.
And rest assured that there is no such accusation from us, from the PLA or the ESL either. We're just merely seeking clarification as to the process that was gone through on the day. I think it would also be useful for us to know who wrote the Hasband software.
I guess that question is around who developed the application or who developed the underlying algorithms that supply the output risk scores.
Well, both would be useful to know.
Okay. The genesis and history of Hasman as a navigation risk software was first developed around about 2000. It came in as a result of the Port Marine Safety Code and the requirement, mostly in port authorities, to undertake a focused formal safety assessment type of navigation risk assessment in line with Port Marine Safety Code requirements. So the underlying risk matrix and the algorithm applied to that was developed in, I guess, 1999 or thereabouts by a chap called John Riding, who's the founder of Marico Marine. It was based on his experience and understanding, having worked in, technical safety case requirements, where he was an ex-seafarer who came ashore and worked for Sellafield, where at the time risk assessment was perhaps a whole lot more developed and advanced than it was necessarily in the boats industry. So within the underlying matrix of how the scores are generated, which you can see and work through on a bit of paper, that was developed by John Riding. The development of a software to put that in place was in terms of Hasman 2, which was a later development of the application, still utilising the same underlying algorithms, was undertaken by a company in Wellington in New Zealand.
Thank you. I don't want to use up too much of the examining authorities or our time here today in asking questions that could be asked outside of this process, so it would be useful to have dialogue with you about other matters that don't need to be addressed today. But I think my colleague Richard Jackson just has a question about the NRAA and how you work out the number of vessels that can use the inshore route as per day.
Richard Jackson, Estuary Services. It's kind of two parts, really, and I think it probably is for you, Ed. But if could we look at figure 16 on the addendum. I know we have, not here obviously, but we've had this conversation briefly with Ed before, but just still trying to get a head around when you're representing, particularly that graphic in the bottom right-hand corner there, and you've got those pilot boats. So that's the position of a pilot boat doing less than 10 knots. Is that right? So that's a pilot. Sorry,
it's probably better or more appropriate for my colleague Jamie Holmes to answer this question, who is more necessarily involved in this bit of the work, if that's okay.
Yeah. Jamie Holmes for the applicant. Yes, these are AIS. These are based on AIS data, and it's effectively a filter that's applied to known vessels. In this case, the launches, of when that vessel is going below the speed that's called out in the plots. So we applied two tests there, one of 7 knots and one of 10 knots.
Okay, good. So when we say sort of low, medium, high, what is low? How often would that pilot boat have to be in that position doing less than 10 knots to be there? I'm just trying to figure out what is high. You know, how often does a vessel have to be there doing 10 knots to be considered high, medium, and low?
Yeah, I understand. I mean, that's a non-dimensioned density plot there. And I think that can be ratioed to the numbers of known transfers, and that's one way of doing it. I should really emphasise this is a proxy to show spatial distribution, and I think indeed we've actually explained that in the report, that it's an indicative indication that is given in parallel with indeed submissions by you in terms of your understanding of your spatial extent of where you undertake your pilotage operations.
Okay. Yeah. Absolutely. Thank you. Sort of moving on, but the same point. So. Just below that graphic, actually, 35, and then we're back to sort of, so we've looked at the bigger data set and we've still come back to this conclusion that there's 11 vessels per day use the inshore route. So, and that, I'm assuming, is purely based on 3978 divided by 365. Is that right?
That's right. That's the calculation that's applied there, yeah.
All I'm thinking is that where I'm still a little bit confused, and why I'm doing this now and not kind of in writing, is it's probably quicker to talk about it.
Yeah, sure.
In the NRA, you've got section 7.13. I don't know if that's possible. Thank you. I can't quite see whether it's just a typo that I found, or whether not quite looking at it right, but it's actually figure 47 that would, as a background anyway to the question. But the section itself is concerned with transits of tidally constrained vessels. Now that is an analysis of the inshore route through the traffic gates. This is a bit where I can't quite tell where I've picked up on a typo. It says it's based on traffic gate C, which is not the inshore route, that's actually route C. But assuming that that is actually the analysis of the right gate and that the C is possibly a typo, it appears to me that, because what we have when we're talking about average vessels transiting through certain areas is over 45% of the time there are no transits. So when we say 11 transits, we're dividing 3,978 by 365, but then we're saying that 45 or over 45% of the time there are no transits. You sort of mean, you're trying to sort of feel like, am I reading it wrong, or is it sort of, as the average perhaps smoothed out that number? Because also what that does show is, although it's obviously a low number, it seems that as the tide falls, the likelihood of a multiple vessel transit through the inshore route increases. So as we see a drop in the tide, we also see, it, for this study, an increase in multiple vessels going through. Would that be fair to say?
Ed Rogers for the applicant. I think the first thing to note about this particular plot is that it's referring to things per hour, so the number of transits that pass through in an hour. Now, necessarily, if there are 11 transits per day, there's not necessarily a transit every individual hour of that day by 11 vessels at the point that this gate was drawn. So on average, if there are 11 vessels a day going through this area, 24 hours in a day, around half the time you'd expect that there are no vessels in a particular hour transiting through. What this analysis kind of demonstrates is that on occurrences where there's multiple vessels transiting through in an hour, there's probably a higher propensity for that to happen towards high tide, and that's demonstrated by the red line. So as the red line goes up, that's the average tidal height. And what we anticipate, and I think what's been demonstrated through the conversations we've had with you, is that in general terms, around high water, there might be more vessels navigating.
Right, okay. And so do you think that is gate C, or do you think that's, do you think the C is a typo, or is it? Because if it was the inshore route, it wouldn't be gate C.
I would have to check that.
That's us.
Can that be checked and verified for deadline 5, please? And if that can be noted as an action.
Alex Tillerstone, PLA and ESL. We have no desire to drag things out today longer than they need to be dragged out, so I think anything that we can further ask to the applicant, we will do so directly.
Mm. On that basis, though, if there are matters that are, in your view, relevant to the Secretary of State's decision, I would urge upon you the virtue of then placing those in writing for deadline 5, and indeed I would say the same to the applicant.
We will, of course, do that, sir.
Thank you very much. Now, London Pilots Council.
Yes, sir. In a sort of similar effort to move things along, I have three comments to make on the evidence from Captain Simon Moore on the marine radar setup, his understanding of pulse length and the radar range scale and use, and also his experience of pilotage of large vessels in the area of the northeast Rakon buoy, in particular slowing down and the requirement for extra sea room that has.
Okay, could you just approach the microphone a little more?
In the interest of moving things along, I'll address these items submission of deadline 5.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Now then, who will speak for Trinity House?
Thank you, sir. Roger Barker on behalf of Trinity House, and I will be very brief. We've made a lot of discussions about the quantitative data through the hazard workshop, and I say quantification because it's a numeracy there. But most of my concerns have been closed out earlier in the day by Mr. Bradley, who asked very pertinent questions about the actual specifics of a situation which couldn't be like general day situation. But my question first is for the applicant and Paul Brown, perhaps, with regard to the simulation study. Because I noted that, and we did discuss it briefly before, but it's essential that we close it out, that the simulation was with all experienced mariners in the area on the simulated bridge. And as such, did that really demonstrate what we needed out of the simulation, which was to provide that element of qualitative risk assessment for the vessels, the ones we worry about, as Mr. Bradley said earlier in the day, the ones that will not necessarily be well-founded, situations that we don't expect on a daily basis, just the unusual. Thank you.
Paul Brown for the applicant. So the answer is yes, they were. The people that drove the vessels were PLA pilots. I didn't put my hand on it, and much as I wanted to, I didn't touch any sticks or do any driving. Likewise, accepting the limitations of the simulator, Estuary Services coxswains drove their bit of the simulation. So it was as realistic, and there was no input whatsoever from me or any of the other observing people in terms of how it was that the simulation was conducted, except for in order to try and because we all stood there as we did this beautiful 250-degree turn, and it took about 20 minutes. So the pilot then started pulsing the engine to increase the rate of turn, and the only input I gave was, let's try and do it how you'd really do it, realistically, rather than trying to do sexy ship handling parts, which is not representative of what you would do at the North East Spit when you're handling a last vessel in those waters.
Yes, okay, but to try and grasp what would the reality, the ship coming through there with no pilot on board, it wasn't really represented because you were using experienced personnel on the bridge who knew the area. So as you said, it went well, but I'm not surprised it went well because they were the experienced guys. But when we say it went well, I understand that with 14 runs and with experienced people on the bridge, out of the 14 runs, there was one failure. Which demonstrated to me,
it wasn't a failure. We breached the proximity by, so it wasn't a failure within the parameters set up in the inception report. So it breached one of the the words are not coming at this time of the day, but it wasn't an outright failure. In terms of should we've got a master mariner to stand on a bridge and drive a ship to the pilot station? Maybe if you wanted to, but actually in the interests of getting the job done with the pilots that were there, it seemed prudent to do that. It might be worth me adding that I came to the simulation expecting it to be a disaster. I came expecting this to be an absolute, with ships going all over the place, and I think we were all pleasantly surprised, is probably not the right word, were surprised at how easy it was. And I don't put that down to the fact that we had ace ninja pilots driving the ships. I do it down to that fact that actually it was actually the skills of the coxswains organising it. And I alluded that to earlier on, to say actually that the secret to this was the coxswain understanding, getting the situational awareness of what was going on in the northeast spit, who was arriving, who was leaving, and then making a clear, quick decision on that. I'd be very, very surprised if ESL or the pilots here would say otherwise. I mean, it was going on today. I've been watching it in marine traffic. I think that's how it happens in real life at the northeast spit.
Thanks very much, and I'd like to add I think the expertise of the pilots and the pilot services is excellent. Thank totally. Goodness for it. But the difficult question we have is the what ifs on the bad day, and that's the question the panel are going to have to answer. So, close out looking towards Dr. Rogers. We've debated for several hours today the areas of quantification on the hazard workshop, the numeracy. And the direct questions from PLA, etc., saying that, you know, were you confident, and were there any problems with that numeracy of the figures? And my reason for asking it is because my experience, which is quite a bit in risk assessment, is that we've got to balance the quantification with the absolute expertise looking at a situation to answer this core question that we need to address. Is the risk being reduced to as low as reasonably practicable? So did you have a gut feeling, Ed, that because of the outcome of the process of the hazard workshop, there was too much uncertainty there? Thank you.
Thank you, Captain Barker. I, at my heart, I'm more a scientist than a mariner, and as a result, I don't necessarily go for gut instincts. I try and understand what the data and the information tells me. Where that data and information isn't necessarily available, then we look at the expertise of the people in the room that can inform that process. Throughout the whole of this examination, I think I've actually become more confident in the ALARP assessment as we've gone through that, and that's as other things have come to light in terms of the risk assessment undertaken by the PLA in 2015 that demonstrates that the area is at the low end of ALARP at the start. In terms of the original NRA coming up with similar outcomes, we see in terms of the addition of an SEZ, and I think the SEZ has been put in place entirely because of the gut instinct of mariners, the qualitative element, as you talk about. And I think that's probably a testament to the applicant that they haven't purely relied on the risk assessment to demonstrate the need for additional controls like the SEZ. So, and I think I'm further encouraged that we have an assessment that is correct or applicable to where we're at, because we have scores of consequence that have come back from the PLA that are also fairly well in line, and a resultant assessment that also demonstrates we're in the same sort of ALARP zone. So to my mind, I'm now probably as confident as I can ever be that in terms of the assessment of risk, we've got a very solid basis there.
Briefly, and with your permission, Captain Barker, Dr. Rogers, would I take it from that response that actually it remains your professional opinion that the SEZ is unnecessary? You referred to it essentially being a response to the gut feeling of mariners, and you then referred to your raised confidence in the underlying approach that you took in risk assessment. I guess what I just wanted to confirm was whether essentially it is your view that the SEZ is a concession, in inverted commas, that is not necessarily fully justified, or whether it is scientifically justified.
Ed Rogers, the applicant. I think the answer to that question is it is justified because it does reduce risk.
Mm.
So in terms of whether...
But was it necessary to address a risk? Would you have been confident to have continued to assert a position where the original NRA and risk assessment essentially played through to the decision point?
I'm confident that the assessment of risk that we undertook in the original NRA is correct and right. So by that virtue, and if a LARP can be proven within that instance, then the SEZ is not necessarily a result of that particular approach. But within any assessment, especially within this field, as we've discussed at length, the qualitative input is included in that. So I guess to answer your question, in pure risk terms, the SEZ wasn't necessary.
Apologies. Captain Barker.
Thanks for that question. Nothing more from me, but Captain Harris just has one question, please.
Trevor Harris for Trinity House. My question's directed more for clarity to Dr. Rogers or maybe Mr. Linus. The workshop carried out over the NRAA, we all came to the consensus that the four items we dealt with were with the SEZ in place. During construction, anything can be placed in the SEZ, whether it's a jack-up, anchor patterns, buoys, and that. And on some construction methods for wind farms, the anchor patterns of construction vessels can extend up to 1,000 metres. During the construction phase and any possible decommissioning phase 25, 30 years down the line, are we to assume the original NRA is the primary document for that time frame?
Not sure if Scott Lannis for the applicant, not sure I fully understand the question about the NRA that would be promoted as part of this scheme is essentially the addendum NRA, which would justify any consent. I'm not sure how that relates to the earlier part of the question about what matters would be within the SEZ. Perhaps I can just deal with that very briefly. The intention behind the SEZ is to make sure that there's no part of any above-sea structures at all would be within the structure exclusion zone, unless dictated by other stakeholders, including yourselves, when reviewing the lighting and marking plan at securing the DCO, for example. So there's no intention for any part of any above-sea structure to be in the SEZ, if that answers your question.
Trevor Harris, Trinity House. That answers the question during the operational phase.
Yes.
During the construction phase,
yes,
and decommissioning phase, even through the DCO and within the SEZ documentation, things can be placed there. Jack-ups, again, above the surface, anchor patterns for anchor handling. They may have buoy markers.
Yes,
and
as I understand it, the use of the SEZ has been applied to preserve the ability to carry out cabling, first of all, but as well as some activities such as jack-up barge placement within the SEZ to allow the project to be safely and efficiently constructed. But we can provide some further details. It's going to assist the examining authority on exactly what we would anticipate in the SEZ during the construction phase.
Yes, that that would be very useful. And by deadline 5. Thank you.
Trevor Harris, yes, thank you very much.
Thank you. Now, any matters arising from MCA?
Yes, please. Thanks, Mr. Chairman. I just wanted to ask Mr. Linus if you could just clarify the issue on the promulgation of information risk control and whether that was going to be included in your submission in deadline 5. So I wasn't quite clear on whether or not you agree that is embedded mitigation or additional.
Scott Lanners for the applicants. I think when we looked at your representation, we recognised that part of the embedded risk control has always been assumed within the NRA, related in part to some promulgation of information. But the way it was drafted was also meant to mean that
there was some extra information being promulgated through the AZON plan, which is not an embedded control. Mm. So we're quite prepared to clarify where the division might lie for the purposes of carrying out any residual risk assessment. We accept the point that there is a degree of promulgation of information in the embedded risk control.
Okay, thank you. It's just liaison plans and listed within the addendum in that bullet point. The second one is referring to the layout plan within paragraph 133. It states that the layout plan will be submitted to MCA for approval prior to construction. MCA clarified that that would need to conform to, will need to meet the requirements of the MGN and the search and rescue guidance, which means optimising line of orientation. And then in paragraph 134, that mitigation is repeated in optimising line of orientation. Simshin is just to ask if you agree that that is a duplicate mitigation measure.
Scott Lannis for the applicant. I'll be corrected by others if I'm wrong, but the optimization of the line of orientation and symmetry has been identified as an additional risk control through the NRA. And to the extent that it is also identified within the liaison, part of the liaison plan, I don't think there's any duplication of mitigation in that sense. It's identified as additional risk control, set quite separately from embedded risk control in the NRA.
Well, the embedded risk control states that a layout plan will be approved by the MCA. As part of that approval process, line of orientation is optimised. So I put it to you that additional risk control measure is a duplicate.
Scott Lannis for the applicant. I think I need to take instructions on that. As I understand it, the intention was for the optimization of line of orientation symmetry to be an additional risk control, but I can clarify that for deadline 5.
Okay. Thank you very much. Again, an action.
Thanks, sir.
Thank you. Mr. Owen.
Robbie Owen, Port of Tilbury and DP World London Gateway. I think there's only in the interest of time one issue I need to ask Mr. Rogers. There's a second point which is more possibly for Mr. Lynas. Not that he's here to be cross-examined, but anyway. The first point is a brief point. Is this Mr. Rogers, which is there's been quite a lot of discussion, obviously, in terms of the whole issue of growth and. You've explained that the figure of 10% was put into the navigational risk assessment. We've explained why we think that is insufficient. I think the panel would find it helpful to understand how you came up with that 10%. I'm interested to know if there's any workings we can see, any document we can see that gets you to that 10%. How did you come up with it? Why 10%? Why not 9? Why 12? And also, can you help us in terms of whether there's any correlation in terms of 10% increase in vessels and a 10% increase in likelihood of accidents and other risks materializing? What is the correlation between the two? So, can you help us there? It may be that again at deadline 5 you can put in a paper that deals with this, but I think we do need to understand if you're saying, well, no, it shouldn't be a higher figure that the ports are wanting. How did you come up with 10%?
Ed Rogers for the applicant. I guess my first response to that is I'm not entirely clear what it is you want in terms of a growth figure. We've discussed about various percentage growth in terms of tonnage.
Well, that wasn't my question. My question was, how did you? There's clearly a dispute between us, but how did you come up with 10%? Why 10%? Why did you choose that? Was it just something you came up with one day? I think we need to understand how. I mean, you're a scientist. You've told us that. Did you come to some sort of scientific process that, did you go through a scientific process that came up with 10% at the end of the day?
Very happy to address that question. But you did ask in reference to the growth figures, there was disparity, and I don't yet understand what that disparity is between what you envisage it to be versus the 10%.
I'm happy to go into it. Not taking too long. There's a kind of basic preliminary question, and that is the where did the 10% come from? And it would assist the examining authority to know the answer to that, and then we can, if needs be, go to the more detailed point, and if necessary, that can be addressed at deadline 5 on both sides.
Certainly. The 10% came from a review of the Thames vision in terms of the anticipated growth in trade that was predicted by the PLA as part of that particular study, and benchmarked against an actual decline in vessel numbers over that time, over the previous period of time that we've seen evident in that, is where the 10% came from.
Is it possible to see a document that shows us that, so we can understand how, sort of on a contemporaneous basis, you did that?
I'm sure we can provide those workings for deadline 5, if that's what you're asking for.
Yes, that'd be very helpful. Thank you. Yeah. So that's all I wanted to ask on that issue. I think we can deal with other things in submissions. But the other point I wanted to make, and we've touched on it a little bit over the last couple of days, is going back to this device of a structures exclusion zone. And it partly relates to something I think was agreed to be provided in response to Mr. Harris's question 5 or 10 minutes ago. But I think the ports would find it helpful to understand more from the applicants, probably more at deadline 5, if not today, the reasoning for a structures exclusion zone, and importantly, what could still be done within the zone, both during construction and during the operation and maintenance period. I've looked at the revised draft DCO, and we had the tracked version produced at deadline 4B. There are lots of references peppered throughout in terms of what can't be done in the SEZ. I would like to know what in the applicant's view, what are they proposing in their draft order that could be done in the SEZ, nevertheless, because it's still within the order limit. So, again, I'm not looking for an answer today in the interest of time, but I think it'd be very helpful if we could be given something on that at deadline 5, please. Is that possible, Mr. Linus?
It is. Scott Linus for the applicant. We have already said we can provide some more information on that issue, and we can do so.
Thank you very much.
So that's all I had to ask. Thank you.
Okay. In which case, that, ladies and gentlemen, I believe brings us to the end of agenda items 5 and 6. So we will now just review where we stand on the agenda more broadly. It's a very long scroll back to the top of these speaking notes. Just bear with me for a second.
Sir, I'm very sorry to interrupt. Scott Lannis for the applicant. Just to confirm, I don't have any re-examination for the witnesses, but there was just one point, perhaps if I could ask you to note it. There was a question put in relation to the marginal result on one of the pilotage runs, and I would ask you just to refer to paragraph 6.3 of the pilot simulation report, which confirms that it was a breach of proximity criteria, but it was in relation to a journey back from after the pilot act had taken place. Just wanted to clarify that pursuant to an answer that Mr. Brown had given. It was still a marginal result.
Yes. Now, in the interests of time, and just looking at the kind of overarching matters raised in agenda items 5 and 6, I think, you know, the examining authority notes the degree to which we've tested everybody's patience and endurance. And so any remaining matters that we wish to ask will have to be deferred to our round 3 of examination questions, EXQ3. You can see in the timetable when they will emerge. We, as we indicated before, folded agenda item 12 into this item. 13 to a degree has been touched. And again, we will review our position in relation to 13 and look at the degree to which we will need to put out further written questions again at EXQ3. I'll just test with my colleagues whether there are any burning matters that need to be dealt with now. Mr. Bradley? Yes. I mean, what I will say is that in relation to any interested party who had particularly wished to put in principle positions on economic and employment effects on marine industries or communities, in the light particularly of the material change request that has been put in front of us, then there is an opportunity to do that in writing at deadline 5. Is everybody content with that? In which case, then, we will move on. Item 14, procedural decisions. Now, there's one relatively minor and simple one. It may not even be a procedural decision. It's probably just an action point, but the applicant did undertake to check around the engagement with the Port of Sheerness and was going to report back to us on that.
Sir, yes, Scott Linus for the applicant. You'll be aware that in the appendix to the deadline 4C letter, there was a list of parties who the applicant intends to consult in relation to the material change.
Yes, and that's a point that we've actually got to move to,
yes,
more broadly.
And the Port of Sheerness are included in that list. And the note in the table that's been supplied to me said that they submitted a relevant representation, but no further submissions to date. Certainly, as far as matters going forward are concerned, we would intend to consult them. I would still need to check the extent to which they were formally consulted at the earlier stage, but
yes,
a relevant representation was submitted.
And particularly whether they, as well, were invited to participate in the NRIA process and the workshop.
Scotland, for the applicant, I don't think they're invited to participate in the NRA workshop, if that's the focus of the question. We will double-check that. And we can report that at deadline 5 as well.
Okay, thank you very much. Which then leads us to there are two other related matters. There's the general matter of arrangements for analogue consultation following AN16 on the material change request. But before we get there, one other matter that's still kind of hovering around, not quite fully landed, and that is this question about whether a further simulation study ought to be done. Now, before we go any further, I'm just going to throw that one back across the table to you, Mr. Linus, and just ask whether it is, in principle, having been through the process we've been through in the last couple of days, still the applicant's view that they would not do that, or whether alternatively there's a view that it will be done. If there's a simple view that it would be done, then all we've got to do is arrange the practicalities.
Scotland, for the applicant, my instructions are as per the position that was expressed,
yeah,
before. We don't think it's necessary for the reasons that were given yesterday, I think. Yes.
Okay. Now, are there any particularly strong remaining views around the table that it is necessary? I know we've been here before and we do note the positions of the parties, but essentially here, we're not going to take any sort of formal procedural decision on this tonight, but if there is a very strong and urgent view remaining, given everything that has now been heard, we would like just to hear a few brief words finally on it, so that we can then deliberate on whether we need to make any further engagement with the applicant on this point. Mr. Owen.
Thank you, sir. We do remain strongly of the view that it should be done. I'm afraid we're not persuaded by what we've heard from the applicants. So the reasons we've given before all still stand. And I would just add this point that time is not on our side, of course, and with Easter weekend coming up, it would be helpful to hear from the examining authority in terms of your position on this as soon as possible, so that we all know where we stand and whether, for example, a new one will have to be done. Because I think the evidence is that, well, that certainly our view is that there is time to do it, but there's not an abundance of time, if I can put it that way.
No,
thank you.
Very clear of that. And rest assured, we are clearly being asked for a decision to be made, and we will endeavour to make one as soon as reasonably practicable. However, I will make clear that it won't be tonight, because I do think that it is something that needs to be slept upon. Is there anybody else who needs to speak on that final point? Noting that we have heard you all on this before and we do know what you think, this is just a moment where you can give us some final re-emphasis if you think it's a very important matter. Mr. Dillerstone.
Alex Dillerstone, PLA and ESL. I would say, in addition to what we have said earlier, that we would reinforce Mr. Owen's point. There is not very much time. We have made our views clear as to whether or not it is required and should be done. But there is not very much time at all if it is to be done. So if we could have a decision as soon as possible, that would be very helpful.
Rest assured, it will be on the top of our mind. That, I think, Mr. Bradley raises a very useful and pertinent point, because essentially we do need to know to inform a decision. If an additional simulation were to be carried out, then, critically, in summary terms, what is being done with it? How does it specifically inform the decision of the Secretary of State? We've had views on that to a limited extent around the table, but I don't think that's a question that has been fully answered.
And I think, rather specifically, is it again to establish feasibility, or is it intended to establish something else? Feasibility of pilot boarding and landing, I should perhaps say.
In the new setting, in the post-SEZ setting.
Scott Lyon for the applicant. Well, it's difficult to answer, actually, because we don't think it's necessary. So I suppose if you were following the logic through, it would depend upon the basis of the panel's decision. If you were telling us that you thought the simulation should be carried out for the reasons that had been given by the other parties, then presumably by accepting those submissions, you'd be telling us that you wanted that simulation to be carried out to establish feasibility. But that is not our position, obviously. So it really depends on the basis of the panel's decision to request the further simulation.
I have to say, I think we are only going to bottom this out with some very careful deliberation, and I'm not minded to do that extempore over this table. I think it would be most unwise, and so I think the best we can achieve here is some deliberation overnight, and we will inform the interested parties as soon as we can. Now, in terms of how we do that, we can obviously speak orally to those who are due to be here tomorrow, but not everybody's going to be here tomorrow because it's a different hearing. But we will, if there is something that needs to be communicated more widely, then clearly we will ask the office to communicate with everybody with an interest in this. Yes. Trinity House.
Trevor Harris for Trinity House. Yes, so we just got one query around an additional simulation, and it goes back to our original concerns on the existing Ridge Simulator project, same as the MCA. The fact is that was done with very experienced people in the area. What people would be used for an additional simulation, and where do we get mariners at such a short notice to use?
Thank you very much. I think we have to leave that in the mix, but there is a final question that I am going to refer back to the ports. We have heard your criticisms of the circumstance where an existing simulation has been carried out relating to an application as proposed with no SEZ, and then your proposition that one ought be carried out in the SEZ condition so that an apple can be compared with an apple. Is there anything else over and above that that you suggest we need to take into consideration in finally reaching a view on this?
Would you just give me 1 minute, sir, please, just to...
Yes, I think everybody's in need of more than a minute. Mr. Owen.
Thank you, sir. That's very helpful. Probably best to hear it from the horse's mouth, as it were, in the form of Mr. Crockett. Mr. Crockett.
Vincent Crockett for Port of Tilbury and London Gateway. Very, very brief. We believe we're talking about a mixture of feasibility and confirmation. I know that's a fudge, but the reason that it's feasibility is that we are looking at ships that have not been examined in the context of there. So there must be an element of feasibility which is required. We've heard from Commander Paul Brown his views, and they're noted, but it still leaves the simple fact that larger ships with vastly increased windage, they must be different. So that's the confirmatory aspect of it, and we simply have no evidence to know that in terms of the future of the two ports, particularly London Gateway, and also LNG carriers, quite specifically we heard about earlier, we simply don't know how those ships will handle in the overall context. I don't want to go through it all again. Yeah. So it's a mixture of confirmation, stroke comfort, and more importantly, basic feasibility.
That assists and provides some clarity, and hopefully we'll be able to deliberate on that basis. Thank you very much. Okay, so we now need to return to the other matters that we need to deal with, and the one matter remaining that I think we must deal with tonight, sadly, is the matter of essentially the settlement of the procedure for the applicant's pursuit of its material change request. Now, we note the annex, Mr. Linus, that you've referred us to with your list of proposed consultees. Now, I guess our starting proposition there is that our general advice to you, our Section 51 advice that we've issued, did not give you any specific guidance to do anything less than a broad analogue process to what you would do in order to satisfy the APFP and the 2017 EIA regs. You have said that it is your view that it would be proportionate and appropriate to consult a smaller class of persons. Now, I think what we can't do is give you any... Because this is a non-statutory process in any case, it's yet again one of these judgmental matters. What we can't give you is any clear comfort that if specific entities who are listed for general consultation in the statutory process and not consulted in this process, that you will not encounter issues that then emerge as a consequence of that. So we can't give you that warranty. However, what we have then done is reviewed that list and had a number of questions about possible entities that are not on it that we wish to put to you for your consideration. We were looking at a group of aviation interests as prospectively needing to be considered. NATS, CAA, the Ministry of Defence, and actually the Ministry of Defence is relevant in relation to maritime activities as well. And also, given its standing as an IP and its local proximity, River Oak strategic partnership in respect of the Manston Airport proposal. So that was one group. In relation to fishing and fisheries, given its standing in this examination, Kent and Essex IFCA, given its standing as another person in this examination, the Government of France, and in the entities that have participated. We're also looking at bodies who are IPs and or of relevance who are non-governmental organisations. And so there, very briefly, RSPB, Kent Wildlife Trust, the National Trust, and then somewhat differently, but still in the same class of persons, the RYA. And then what we thought more broadly is that if you direct yourself to the Statement of Common Ground list in the Rule 6 letter, and you also consider more broadly the list of interested parties and other persons already engaged in this examination process overall, because I guess fundamentally our starting point would be that as a bare minimum, consultation should not kind of willfully exclude people who have formally expressed an interest in the matter that we're examining. Now, as I say, we can't give you any warranties that a limited process is going to be necessarily safe. Yeah. But
Scott Lanners for the applicant. That's duly noted. Sir, we understand that. We've set out our position, and we discussed it before, as to why we're going to take this approach. We'll take that list of extra parties away. We understand the reasons why you're suggesting that perhaps tomorrow come back and confirm the position.
Indeed, and we've got business sessions in two hearings tomorrow where we can revisit that.
Yes, we'll check that. We'll check that list. And I can take final instructions on whether or not that will be carried out. But we understand the reasons why you're suggesting.
Yeah. Now, the final thing to deliberate on overnight that I'm not sure whether we did bed down, because there was this initial view that deadline 6 would be a struggle, which would be necessary to meet our original procedural decision. I believe you had put back to us on deliberation earlier on in this hearing that you thought deadline 6 could be achieved. Are you still confident that it can be?
Yeah. I'm just confirming. Yes, we do. Even though there may be more consultees to add to the list, we still think that deadline 6 is achievable within the parameters that we've set out before the examination.
In which case...
I should say that at the moment we're anticipating sending out the consultation next week, and that would allow... the consultation period to be achieved before deadline 6 with the preparation of the consultation report.
Yes. Okay. Just a quick check, ladies and gentlemen, on updates on statements of common ground, but that is provided for at deadline 5, so that's not a matter that we need to deal with. Are there any other matters that anybody wants to suggest we ought to make procedural decisions or provide guidance about? Stunned silence. Everybody can see their tea in front of them. We will review our action list rather than running through it laboriously line by line now. I think, you know, we're way beyond the level of patience necessary to do that as an exercise. So next steps, item 16 on the agenda, are to remind you that compulsory acquisition hearing 2 will be here. And I think it's important to emphasise that we will be commencing that at 10 a.m. here tomorrow morning. And then, having dealt with that business in the morning, we will finally deal with a hearing on the DCO, ISH 9, here at 2 p.m. So unless there's anything else that anybody wants to say on any of the maritime matters, Mr. Owen.
Two very quick points, sir. Firstly... we did say during the break we would look into the issue about the vessel counts and deadline 2. We haven't actually been able to conclude that. So if I can just commit to doing so as part of our deadline 5
deadline
submissions.
Five submission.
Yes, I'm sorry, it just wasn't possible given everything else going on. So just to own up to that. And finally, in relation to sort of policy submissions, did I note you correctly as having said yesterday that it'd be deadline 8 for final policy positions, because obviously we want to reflect on yesterday's discussions.
Yeah, I believe we'd said deadline 7, because the reason for that is that, you know, in simple terms, if an IP is making a policy submission, then there needs to be a right in the applicant to respond to it.
Yes, deadline 7.
So it is deadline 7,
Super.
Not deadline 8.
Thank you very much.
Excellent. Ladies and gentlemen, we are done. You are
done.
Relieved. Good evening. We'll now close the hearing.